from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. Earlier this month, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in a case that some experts predict could have an even bigger impact than the Citizens United ruling from 2010, which eliminated the ban on corporate spending in elections. The ruling in McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission could determine whether or not the government can limit individual donations to federal candidates. We'll talk about the case, the role of money in politics, and the rise of leadership PACs. Fundraising committees, critics say, are being used as unregulated personal slush funds for legislators. That's after this on Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in today for Michael Krasny. The U.S. Supreme Court is once again looking at the mother's milk of politics, campaign contributions. The court's decision in the 2010 Citizens United case opened a floodgate for contributions by corporations and labor unions. The current case, McCutcheon versus FEC, deals with whether overall political contribution limits violate the First Amendment. Now we're watching to see if the highest court in the land will move to loosen restrictions on campaign spending even further than it has already. In this hour, we'll talk about this case and other developments in the world of money and politics. Joining us first is Josh Gerstein, senior White House reporter for Politico.
Hello.
Hi, Josh. Can you lay out the McCutcheon versus FEC case for us in broad detail?
Well, we had it argued at the Supreme Court just a few weeks ago, and it essentially relates to some caps that most people probably don't even know about. I think a lot of people are aware that when you make a donation to a federal candidate, be it for president or for the Senate or the House, there's a limit of about $2,500 or so, maybe about $5,000 in the course of a primary and a general election. But there are also limits that apply that prevent you from sort of making an unlimited number of large donations. Depending on which committees you're giving to, they can range from about $35,000 to $50,000 or more. About $48,000, I think, is the cap for candidate committees, and up to $75,000 for parties and so forth. But they essentially prevent someone from, say, giving a donation to every candidate running for a particular party. And those were the caps that were being argued at the Supreme Court. I think the most interesting part of the argument was sort of a hypothetical that was put forward and appeared in the lower court rulings on this issue, that if these caps were lifted, you could see sort of fundraising events where people could chain together their donations at a single fundraiser and potentially give hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars at a single fundraising event, and then see that money distributed out to various candidates and campaigns. It's really a question about whether this would bring back what people call the soft money days that were, around 10 or more years ago, where you had companies and individuals making donations of $100,000, $200,000 or more to political parties.
Let's hear first, I guess, what the president of the United States has to say. Here he is speaking just a few days ago at the White House.
This case would go even further than Citizens United. I mean, essentially, it would say anything goes. There are no rules in terms of how to finance campaigns. There aren't a lot of functioning democracies around the world that work this way, where you can basically have millionaires and billionaires bankrolling whoever they want, however they want, in some cases undisclosed. And what it means is ordinary Americans are shut out of the process.
Well, that's a Democratic president speaking. Naturally, if you're conservative, you might have a different perspective on that. Do we have a sense, Josh Gerstein, of how the Supreme Court breaks down in terms of their political leanings?
Well, it was hard to tell precisely where people were going to come out in the argument. It looked like the court would, part of the Democrats or the Democratic appointed justices on the court sort of favored keeping the current structure in place, that the Republican appointed justices, by and large, thought that this was unconstitutional, that it was unfair and violated the First Amendment. And it seemed that Justice Anthony Kennedy was probably in the middle or potentially the swing vote. And he made statements at the argument that supported either side of the argument. It wasn't entirely clear from what he said where he was going to come down. So I'd rate it as something of a toss-up at the moment, though obviously the overall trend from the Supreme Court has been to lift a lot of these limits and restrictions that have been in place for the last decade or over the last several decades.
Of course, no more dramatically than in the Citizens United case. Can you explain how this case is different from that case?
Well, the Citizens United case involved more the question of whether corporations could make independent expenditures for or against candidates. And I think its impact may have been exaggerated a little bit. We didn't really see a huge number of large corporations that were interested in doing those kinds of independent expenditures, by which I mean not donating directly to candidates' campaigns, but perhaps taking out advertisements for or against them. It doesn't seem like a lot of companies are really interested in doing that in the political process, at least large companies that do business with the public, because you'll lose a significant part of your customer base if you do that. But it is true that Citizens United decision set in motion some lower court rulings, in particular one called Speech Now, which said that individuals could join together, form companies or funds that would do independent expenditure campaigns. And it was that was behind a lot of the flood of money that we saw in the last presidential election, where you had these so-called super PACs, people that were allegedly or ostensibly independent of the candidates. Nonetheless, the whole organization was formed to support the candidates. And we saw these groups form on the Republican side, and then ultimately also to support President Obama. This case is just sort of, I think you might say, trying to put another chip in the wall here of the campaign finance laws among the people who think that they are an infringement of free speech. They're trying to sort of take down sort of the next logical chunk, and some people see it eventually leading to the dismantling of those laws. I think others would say, the laws are already essentially in tatters, that the super PACs that we saw in the 2012 election really represent a huge volume of money flowing towards specific candidates, even though they were nominally independent of the presidential campaigns.
One last question. Liberal Justice Stephen Breyer urged his colleagues to send this case back to a lower court, to let the arguments play out in a lower court. Is there any sense that that might happen here?
I think it's possible. It's very hard to know how individual justices will approach that, given that Justice Kennedy made comments on both sides of the case at one point. Even Chief Justice Roberts seemed more concerned about one aspect of these restrictions, which is the notion that you can't give a maximum donation to more than about 9 candidates in a given cycle. That seemed to trouble him. The notion that you can't give huge volumes of money to the political parties didn't seem to worry the Chief Justice as much. So I think there's some possibility it could be punted back to the lower court for it would really be to explore the issue of whether there are alternatives to these limits. Could these limits be higher and still be effective? Or are there other means, perhaps stricter enforcement of coordination between independent groups, so-called super PACs or other political committees and candidates? And there also was a lot of confusion, I think, at the Supreme Court about whether this scenario where one could potentially come in with a multi-hundred-thousand-dollar check or even $1 million check to a single fundraiser and then see it doled out to a bunch of different committees, was that in fact a realistic possibility, or do the existing rules preclude that? It's very hard to know if the existing rules preclude that, because the Federal Election Commission has essentially been in many ways inoperative on a lot of these issues for the last few years.
Well, Josh Gerstein, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Josh Gerstein is senior White House reporter for Politico. We also have on the line with us today Peter Schweitzer, a conservative commentator and author of Extortion, How Politicians Extract Your Money, Buy Votes, and Line Their Own Pockets, as well as Jim Sutton here in studio, professor of law at Hastings College of Law, founder of the Sutton Law Firm, specializing in political and election law and litigation. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And last but not least, Sheila Krumholtz, executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics and OpenSecrets.org, which tracks federal campaign contributions and lobbying activity. Sheila Krumholtz, we've heard from Josh Gerstein of Politico that a lot of people think the floodgates are already open. As far as you see it, what's at stake in this case?
Well, we think what is at stake is potentially, further widening the floodgates. There, the money has not come in the way that some anticipated from corporations and unions to be spent directly on independent expenditures. But huge sums of money are now flowing in that weren't there before, and we've been tracking that over time. So you can see a real sharp increase in spending on politics in 2012, and increasingly coming from unknown sources. This would, in McCutcheon, would be different in the sense that this would remove those aggregate limits on individual contributors giving to candidates, PACs, and parties, and those contributions would need to be disclosed, but it would open up an opportunity for more money to come in and from fewer sources. And so we see the potential for, again, a kind of narrowing of who's really playing an important role in funding politics at the federal level.
Peter Schweitzer, as you're listening to this, it would seem in many ways that the U.S. Supreme Court is sort of case by case, attacking campaign finance law in a piecemeal fashion, or am I reading this wrong?
No, I think that's probably pretty accurate. We obviously live in a country that functions on case law, and I think that over the last 40 years, we have tried to erect a number of, and I think many of them very, very good, laws designed to at least limit or contain the influence that outside forces have on the political process. I do think, though, that we have tilted, if you think of this as a marketplace of influence where there are buyers and sellers of influence, I think that most of the restrictions have been focused on the buyers of influence, outside companies, labor unions, et cetera, and there's been less and less regulation of the sellers of influence, the politicians. And I think that's really, when I look at the McCutcheon case, what concerns me is not just the ability of somebody to choose to write a large check to have it split up, but literally to have somebody who might be vulnerable to be approached by a political official and say, look, I need you to write this check to all these different people, or bad things are going to happen to your company. So I think it creates a potential for greater extortion as well.
You know, you've written a lot about leadership PACs, and I'm wondering if you can sort of explain them for the benefit of people who haven't been following this phenomenon.
Yes, I would be glad to. And I would also recommend that anyone interested in studying leadership PACs go to OpenSecrets.org. It's a great resource. I use it all the time. You just need to find the name of the leadership PAC you're looking for with the candidate. Leadership PAC is basically originally established, as the name implies, for those who were going to be in leadership positions in politics, who wanted to raise campaign money and then use those funds to help elect like-minded party members. So you would expect the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader and others to have them, because not only was it a way of increasing the majority or the number of seats that you have in the House or the Senate, it's also a way of, when you're running for a leadership position, to get their support. The problem is that, in my mind, is it has sort of morphed into something larger than that. I mean, you have people with leadership PACs, forming leadership PACs before they even take their seat in Congress. And unlike regular campaign committees, which do have restrictions, I think pretty good restrictions, on how campaign funds can be used, leadership pacts, as far as the FEC authority is concerned, are pretty wide open. And I think that's where you run into the problem where, you know, funds are being used, you know, to take trips overseas, to go to five-star resorts. They resemble more a subsidy, a lifestyle subsidy. And I think even more concerning is that when you look at where most of the money from the leadership pacts comes from, it's not from constituents back in the home state or district. It's largely from corporate and labor union pacts or from individual lobbyists who are writing checks to these leadership pacts.
Professor Sutton, if PACs and super PACs and leadership PACs can get around all these spending limits as it is, would it be better if we had no limits at all?
Well, that's certainly an idea that's getting more and more discussion. And here in California, there are some local jurisdictions that don't have any limits. I was involved a few years ago with a task force in San Diego that looked at that very question, looked at the question of what limits should be, and brought in professionals, campaign consultants, pollsters. And their position was that candidates will really self-regulate, that a candidate won't take the large check from the real estate developer or the car company or the public employee labor union because there will be such a backlash in the campaign against them, and that in a way it would set a whatever that limit would be, and you wouldn't have the big influxes of cash going into the campaign. And if you did, that candidate would more likely than not be elected.
And yet we see so many examples. It's my job to read the news all day long, and yet I can't keep track of all the politicians at the federal, state, local level. It seems like a lot of them get away with a fair amount of nefarious activity.
Well, if that's true, I guess you would blame it on the regulators for not doing their job more, the regulators being the district attorneys or the Federal Elections Commission, as Peter mentioned, which has just been kind of dormant for so many years. But I think, Rachel, you underestimate your own influence. I think the press does a very good job of exposing when candidates are getting money from places that people might be interested in.
What do you think could be done to help the regulators be more effective? Is it that they're, you know, sloughing off on the job? Are they understaffed, underbudgeted? What's the deal?
There's definitely they do not have the staff to truly regulate all the campaigns that are under their jurisdiction. But frankly, there's also the flip side of it, where you have the state and the federal agencies that have so many jurisdictions under them, and they have to regulate campaigns in all these jurisdictions. But now there's been a proliferation in California of local ethics commissions. Los Angeles was the first, followed by San Francisco, San Jose, Santa Clara County. And now you see even smaller cities getting local ethics commissions. And to be very frank, there's not necessarily enough violations of the law in those jurisdictions. So you have those jurisdictions, kind of a bureaucracy creating new laws, creating new forms, creating new reporting requirements, simply to give them something to do to justify their budgets.
A rosy picture there from Professor Sutton. Sheila Krumholtz, is that your sense of things? What do you make of leadership PACs?
Well, we're, of course, focused at the federal level, but my sense of leadership PACs is that it is, as it's long been described, just an extra pocket of the politician's code, an extra kitty, or in some cases really a slush fund, that they may have at their disposal. They may in fact use it for personal use. And we've seen folks go to jail. Representative Jesse Jackson Jr. going to jail for personal use of his campaign funds, which is prohibited. But if he were simply to have used his leadership PAC, it would have been hunky-dory. But so that, I think, is a discrepancy that is not acceptable. I think most people would not want to see their contributions going to keep members of Congress in a comfy lifestyle. They want them to be used to further the political messages. So there are lots of problems about the leadership PACs, and of course that's further worsened by the fact that we do not have a truly functional Federal Election Commission and haven't for some time.
So what you're describing here is prosecutors, at least some of them, on the case using existing law. If, you know, you had a governor or the president on the phone saying, Sheila, help me craft new law, new regulation, what would you suggest?
Well, I think one serious piece of legislation that's been put forward, and I'm sure there are other versions of it, is the Leadership PAC Limitation Act that's been sponsored by Representative Capuano. I think he has no co-sponsors, but that would prohibit members from using funds raised under their leadership PACs for personal use. But in fact, the FEC, as kind of neutered as it's been over the last many years, the FEC itself has supported on a bipartisan basis that the personal use ban should be extended to all federal political committees. So that's a pretty telling indictment of this practice, that they, even they, are willing to tell Congress that they should ban personal use for any political committee. That means PACs and super PACs and you name it, any everything.
Peter Schweitzer, what do you make of the Leadership PAC Act, lonely hunting for sponsors there on Capitol Hill?
Well, I think that was a very good description of the status of it. I think that would be a good change to take place. I think that, in my belief, I think what we really need to do is look at greater transparency, where we have more immediate disclosure of campaign donations as they come in. I mean, this is, the internet era. We're well into it. So we ought to be able to see donations in real time as they flow in. The other thing that I propose is looking at maybe changing the manner in which we approach this issue. If our concern is that there is this influence, and I think a legitimate one, this influence of money on the political process, on lawmaking, why not at least consider, it's certainly not going to be a panacea and fix everything, why not consider, though, in Washington, doing what is done on the state level in Florida, where I live, and at least 27 other states, where they have laws and they have rules in place that say, if the legislature is in session, that members cannot solicit and they cannot receive campaign contributions. If you apply that in Washington, I think it would create, first of all, a lot of chaos, but I think it would potentially, optimistically, have two effects. The first one is it would at least somewhat create some sunlight between the process of money making and solicitation and lawmaking. And second of all, maybe it would actually lead Congress to be more efficient. They stay in town and have a long session where they get very little done, but they use that time to do a lot of fundraising. If they were basically put in a position to say, when you're making laws, you're making laws, you go solicit donations later on, I think that could potentially have a helpful effect on the process.
Do you think that there are ways for the public to pay better, greater, easier attention online?
I do. I think, as I mentioned earlier, I think Open Secrets does a great job. Maplight.org is another online tool. Again, to me, it's a little bit troubling. It's similar to what we went through with the Stock Act in dealing with, possibilities of insider trading by members of Congress. Before, members of Congress were only disclosing their personal finances one time a year on paper to the Ethics Committee, and it was nonprofit organizations that were putting those up online, like Open Secrets. Same thing with donations. Why are they doing quarterly reports? Why can't they simply report in real time as donations are coming in? Because once you start to look at the timing, it becomes very, very interesting. So if people could see, let's say, that a big healthcare bill is being debated and there's a lot of healthcare checks coming in at the same time, that provides a lot of good information for people.
Peter Schweitzer, author of Extortion, How Politics Extract Your Money by Votes and Line Their Own Pockets. We're talking about campaign finance reform. What do you want to know? What do you wish was available to the public to help determine what's going on and what to do about it? What do you think about what the U.S. Supreme Court is considering? Call us at Forum, 866-733-6786. And now that you have a pen at the ready, 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org. Or you can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments and questions online. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. This hour, we're talking about campaign finance reform with Peter Schweitzer, a conservative commentator and author of Extortion, How Politicians Extract Your Money, Buy Votes, and Line Their Own Pockets, Sheila Krumholtz, executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics, and OpenSecrets.org, which tracks federal campaign contributions and lobbying activities, and Professor Jim Sutton at Hastings College of Law, founder of the Sutton Law Firm, specializing in political and election law and litigation. Professor Sutton, later today in Sacramento, Anne Ravel, in her last act as head of the Fair Political Practices Commission, is going to levy a historic fine against a couple of nonprofits that funneled money into two major propositions during the last major campaign in California and weren't entirely open about who was providing the money and where was it going. What's your sense of that as an example of how unclear, how opaque the system is?
Well, actually, I think it's an example of how clear the system is here in California and how the California regulators are doing such a better job than the federal regulators are. In the last presidential cycle, and Sheila even referred to it in her comments earlier today, there was all this quote-unquote secret money and anonymous money flowing through 501c4 nonprofits, and no one knew where the money was coming from. And that was part of this FBC case. There's been a regulation on the book for years in California that if you give money to a C4 and you know the C4 is going to spend that money in politics, you have to be disclosed as the donor. Now, obviously, the two 501c4s at issue in this FPBC case either weren't familiar with that law, and that's very possible because they were operating on the federal level. That's shame on them, right? Because the law has been on the books for years and it was just revised about a year ago.
And that's their business. That's what they're in business to do. So presumably they know the playbook.
Or they chose not to pay attention to it. Or they chose to kind of think they might be able to get away with it. But as I said, the law is well thought out and it's been on the books for years. And this is an example of what happens when you break the law in California. It's a historic fine and will certainly send a message to the national organizations who want to get involved in California elections in the future that they need to pay attention to these rules.
Sheila Krumholtz, is that your read of what's happening?
You know what? I've been having some technical difficulties, so I didn't hear the question. Could you repeat it?
Well, so basically talking about this historic fine that's going to be levied against a couple of organizations, at least one of which historically gets a lot of money from David and Charles Koch, the brothers on the conservative side of the system, you know, and the argument I suppose you could make if you are appalled by this fine is to say here's an example of people trying to work the system even though the rules are fairly clear. Or you could take the position this is a classic example of a group that didn't play by the rules and then got smacked down.
Well, we would take the latter view simply because the single thing we focus on, we advocate, is transparency. And it's a distinction without a difference to say that they are disclosing the donors being ultimately Americans for Job Security, but not really telling us where the money originated. So it's actually, I think, pretty insulting to say that's adequate disclosure. That is not sufficient. And I would agree with the California Fair Political Practices Commission's view that they need to know where the money actually originated. That they don't. The voters do in order to know and understand what not just what the message is, but who the messengers are advocating for and against these propositions.
Could it, though, be seen as a success story that I guess it was Common Cause of California spotted what was happening, at least from the amount of disclosure that was available, and then sort of set the state regulators on the case?
Yes, and kudos to them for being on the job, but it came, this happened kind of, it was down to the 11th hour of that campaign, and so it's unfortunate that people were really trying to absorb the messages, understand, and make their own judgments right before they headed to the ballot box without all of the information that they were due, I think. So, and unfortunately, my understanding of this fine is that we'll never know the donors, that this is a settlement, which you know, yes, they were levied a fine, and that's good, but you never know how much of a deterrent such fines will become. Perhaps it'll just be kind of factored in as a cost of doing business in the future.
Peter Schweitzer, have you been following this case at all?
Yes, a little bit. Not as much as your other guests. But I think, you know, the bottom line challenge that we are going to face is that individuals are going to be ingenious when it comes to moving money around and getting around laws. I mean, you had in Nevada in 2010, for example, and this was broken by a local reporter, John Ralston, Las Vegas Sun, that Harry Reid's son was running for governor, and they had set up something like 900 political action committees where donors were sending donations to all of those PACs, and then those PACs were sending donations all to the campaign. You know, you look at that, and certainly there are questions that are raised, but from a legal standpoint, I don't know if there's a violation of the law there or not. So I would echo what was said earlier. I think transparency is key, as much transparency as possible, and also recognize this is an influence marketplace with buyers and sellers, and we need to also look at restricting the sellers of influence, which are the politicians themselves.
Peter Schweitzer, I'm wondering if you can talk to this question of mine. You know, right now, just given the way the lay of the land is, we have a lot of conservatives in the United States lining up to fight the existing rules about campaign finance law. But this wasn't always the case. And I'm curious, you know, whether you feel like you're a voice wandering in the wilderness or if you want, if it's something you can speak to.
No, I don't think I'm a voice wandering the wilderness. I certainly can't speak for everyone. I mean, you know, conservatives tend to, particularly if those that have a libertarian inclination, tend to be pretty much individualistic, and I couldn't speak to them. What I would say is that there is this sense, though, that with a lot of the campaign finance efforts, reform efforts over the last 40 years, there has been this, I think, notion that, you know, people that come to Washington, they're kind of like Jimmy Stewart and Mr. Smith goes to Washington. They have these wonderful, noble goals, and if we can just sort of keep these terrible, corrupt influences away, everything will be fine. I think human nature is kind of a constant, and I think that just like you have bad actors in the private sector, you have them in the public sector too. So I think the concern that a lot of conservatives have had is that the focus has been primarily on restricting the private sector rather than restricting politicians. And, you know, there have been surveys done that show over half of corporate executives that give campaign donations say that their prime reason for giving the donation is they fear if they don't that bad things will happen to their company or to their industry. And I think that's a very real concern.
I suppose it's worth noting, too, that a great number of major United States corporations tend to give to both sides. Or if there are three sides, they give to three sides. Just are you hoping to hedge their bets? Whoever wins, that person won't be angry or not too angry if the other candidate got more money. Let's take this conversation to the phones now. We've got Noel in Oakland.
Hey, yeah, thank you. You know, I get this impression. I worked in politics for a time as a junior staffer, and you know, the perception is that this phenomenon of favor banking is just out of control. I mean, Barbara Boxer, her entire early career resume was falsified by her handlers, and yet, you know, there's no interest by the press to cover the story. I was wondering if you could respond to that.
Sheila Krumholtz, you want to take to that?
I'm not aware of the questions around Boxer, but I do think that the picture is more nuanced, and I would absolutely echo what Peter said, that the pressure can and does come from both directions. We did a study, in fact, I think it was back in 1988, that interviewed PAC directors in Washington, and it was completely anonymous so that they would feel free to share their true views, and they felt that it was a case of extortion, that they couldn't afford to stand down. They had to play the game for fear that their competitors would use their noble, you know, decision not to use money to curry favor as a leg up on them. So I think that has always been an aspect of this, that there is pressure from both sides. So part of the problem there too is that Congress, at least at the federal level, Congress is responsible for creating the laws that govern disclosure, and you know, so there is an inherent conflict of interest. And it's not at all surprising to many that they would not be forthcoming with budget, you know, the necessary budget for the FEC to do their job adequately to oversee it. In fact, there was a member of Congress who was offended that the FEC performed a random audit of his campaign, and after that, you know, he sponsored the legislation, and no more random audits of campaigns. So, in fact, the FEC is precluded from doing audits unless there is cause. And so, I think there are a number of ways that this could be addressed, not just from the perspective of limiting donors.
Bradley and Alameda emails to ask, given that recent and current Supreme Court positions on campaign funding hinge on the First Amendment right to free speech, yet have granted an infinitely louder voice to those who can pay for the privilege, is there some point where this imbalance can or will be perceived as threatening the democracy, the very heart of our nation and Constitution? Professor Sutton?
Well, I think Bradley's comment is that, first of all, I'm glad that someone raised the First Amendment, because all of the money being raised and spent is the purest and highest form of political speech and so important in a democracy. But I think there's a lot of hyperbole out there about kiddies and slush funds and steep increases. And I think especially here in California, the situation is maybe not quite as dire as some commentators might make it out to be. Yes, there is a lot. There's this chance of big money going into campaigns. But you know what? It's big money on every side. There are wealthy Democrats. There are wealthy Republicans. There are corporations. But 10 of the 15 top givers, according to Open Secrets, are public employee unions. So the money really is on all sides of the equation. And it's the classic marketplace of ideas to get all these ideas out there.
Except for the people who don't have the money to play that game. I don't disagree that money is utilized by players on both sides of the aisle and all political perspectives, but and it is not the Center for Responsive Politics' goal to get big money out of politics. That's not why we're here. We're simply here to put the facts out there and let the chips fall where they may, let people draw their own conclusions. So, again, we're advocating transparency, but I don't think it's fair to say that this is, you know, a red herring. There are freedom of, you know, First Amendment rights concerns that are real, but there are also concerns about corruption and about exclusion by the vast majority of Americans who can't afford to participate in this way.
I find it very difficult, though, to hear about exclusion, where we have the most current example of our president, who was elected raising over $80 million with, I believe, historically the largest number of small donors that were giving to him. So it seems like and now you have people that are making campaign contributions through their mobile phones, that it's, there's probably more participation by more people in campaigns than there's ever been.
Which is fantastic. And we would support that and hope that both parties would find ways to incorporate more small donors as part of the process. And I think getting rid of soft money back in 2002 was part of what cut, particularly for the Democrats, their dependence on a few deep pockets and their need to then reach out to more Americans to be part of the process and to find ways for them to ultimately be an important force by giving simply, you know, $10, $50, $100 as opposed to $100,000 or $1 million. So that was, I think, a healthy change ultimately for the parties and for democracy.
Kevin emails to ask, so long as campaign expenditure is private and unlimited, parties and politicians will always be motivated to find ways to game the system. Why doesn't anyone address that elephant in the room? Peter Schweitzer, you want to take that on?
Well, I think it's a good question. I don't think it's quite fair to say unlimited. I think there is an important distinction that I think everyone here would recognize, is that you certainly don't have unlimited contributions towards individual candidates. Now, you know, super PACs, of course, can serve that function. But a lot of times when you're talking about donors putting large sums of money into political campaigns or running their own independent expenditures, it's because of certain issues that motivate them. They may be staunch environmentalists, they may be, free market conservatives, and I do think that is a First Amendment issue. I mean, in an age of, television and communications, I think people's ability or desire to spend money to say, I believe in a strong environment, or I believe in, a strong national defense, or whatever, is every bit as much a right as somebody, to protest. I think the question becomes when individuals are writing checks or doing things in a financial way that help individual candidates, that's when you get the cronyism and the corruption and the concerns that relate to the process. And as we've discussed, that goes both ways. So I would agree that the First Amendment issue is very central. And I think we can't confuse the fact that there are very real restrictions on contributions that people can make to individual candidates. I think when it comes to issues, though, I think that is a First Amendment right, and I would have real problems with efforts to restrict it.
Let's turn back to the phones now. Paul is calling from Nashville, Tennessee.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
For sure. What's your question?
As a matter of campaign finance only, I think that transparency and disclosure are both beautiful ideas, but they both presuppose an educated and an involved populace, and I travel this country, and I'm afraid I see very little of either. So my question is, outside of practical aspects, the political aspects, why can't we have a 100% publicly financed campaign system? Now, listen off air. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a great question. Sheila Krumholtz?
Well, we're not an advocacy organization. We take no position on public financing. There are organizations that are dedicated to that effort, both at the state and federal level, organizations like Public Campaign in particular. But that is something really for the public to coalesce on and agree on. If they are going to look to public financing as the solution to this problem, which we have had, I believe, since our founding days, because our system has always relied on private financing, then they are going to need to raise a fuss and make it clear to members of Congress that this is their position, because up until now there has not been sufficient coalition to push for that progress. There are lots of efforts on the ground, not just Public Campaign, but other organizations. So I think it's a serious and fair point. But to his point about needing an educated and involved populace, we need that either way, whether or not we get public financing or not. So my hope is that by ensuring and defending transparency, because it has been under attack lately in particular, we at least provide the opportunity for people to have this conversation without knowing, without having access to the information about how our system really operates. They can't even start that conversation.
Ben writes on the website, the press is a shamer of politicians, only works so well. Americans get fatigued easily at politicians' stories of corruption, but that does not change the fact the rules are being broken. Dave writes, trying to equalize or legislate these campaign contribution laws is just messing around the margins. We need comprehensive campaign finance reform, and we need it now. Until we get the money out of this system, it's all rotten. Let's turn back to the phones. We've got Heidi in Los Gatos.
Hi. In the era of social media, I see power and influence really shifting from institutions to individuals. So with that context, do you think campaign finance really matters, or is the information easy for people to access through social media?
Professor Sutton, you want to grab that one?
Well, I think if that is true, that social media is empowering individuals to get more involved with campaigns and more involved with governance, then that kind of counters a lot of the comments about the needs for more regulation or the needs for more public financing. And again, I use again the example of the Obama campaign, where we really do have more individuals involved in campaigns than we ever have seen before.
Peter Schweitzer?
Well, to go to the issue of public financing, you know, call me a cynic, but any system of public financing is going to be written and drawn up by campaign, by existing candidates or existing members of Congress, and they're going to establish it in a way that helps incumbents. So I don't think that public financing is the way to go. It's going to end up, I think, being an incumbent protection racket, and I think that, you know, oftentimes the comparison is made to other countries in Europe, for example, that have public financing, but those are parliamentary systems. That's a different form of government that has a lot of different distinctions as it relates to party, who you're actually voting for. I just think that it's not a solution to the problems that we have, in that it's going to continue to be an insider's club. And I do think the caller is right. I do think that social media is transforming the landscape, certainly as the professor mentioned with the Obama campaign, and I think we're going to see more and more of that increasingly. A lot of people sending $3 donations rather than, you know, a cocktail reception where you're collecting, you know, $2,000 checks.
Mark from Berkeley writes, part of the problem is illustrated by this discussion. The public and the media are so accustomed to tacitly endorsing the machinations of power that we can't even call this what it is, a bribe. When the media hear of a corporation giving money to an African government official who uses it to take his family on a 4-star trip, they have no problem calling it by name. Why can't they see the same when the politician is an American? Peter Schweitzer, I hear you giggling on the phone line.
Yes, it's funny because actually there's a chapter in my book on that very issue. If you look at corporations, American corporations being prosecuted or investigated by Department of Justice under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and you look at what they're being charged with, that goes on in Washington, D.C. all the time. And a lot of it doesn't even go to the issue of campaign financing. Right now, for example, J.P. Morgan is facing potential charges because they were hiring Chinese government officials' children as interns to work at J.P. Morgan. Well, I mean, you've got, I don't know how many members of the Senate and the House who have family members who are lobbyists, who are hired for one reason, because of their last name and their relationships. And yet that's completely acceptable. So I think the writer has a very, very good point, and it goes to kind of the culture that we have operating in Washington today.
Professor Sutton, I see you shaking your head there.
Well, I would disagree that campaign contributions are bribes. I mean, I guess sometimes they are, and we have laws to regulate that. I know that I have written checks to candidates. My wife has written checks, and I feel very comfortable that when we give money to candidates, it's because they're either friends of ours or family members, and of course you're going to help them in their endeavors, or you support their positions. You're not giving because you want something back from them. You're giving because you want pro-choice candidates in office. You want pro-business candidates in office. And that is, I would feel very comfortable saying, the vast majority of money that's given are for those reasons, because people want those kind of ideologies to be in the government. And when there is bribery, when there's extortion, again, there have been laws on the books forever, and all we need is the regulators to go after those examples.
Sheila Krumholtz, do you want to jump in there?
I would just add to that, we also need transparency so that they can go after them based upon the facts. Because just as Common Cause would never have known about these ultimately secret donations that ended up supporting millions of dollars, supporting these two propositions in California, were it not for that at least, you know, basic level of transparency in Washington and state capitals across the country. We need to have evidence in order to even know that something might be going on, and for law enforcement agencies to pursue it.
Let's turn now to Danny in San Francisco.
Hi there. As I listen to this program, I've become angrier and angrier at just people saying, oh, well, isn't it wonderful how people can now donate by cell phone? That's what happened to a vote. So many people don't vote. And the reason why they don't vote, because of the money and the politics. And it really, individual donations is incrementally better than corporate donations, but you've got to level the playing field, and then people will start to become interested again. Publicly financed elections, publicly financed campaigns, it's only way to go. And just to say, we'll never get that, is no reason to not discuss it. And I cannot believe the rationalizations I'm hearing about this. Just kind of blowing my mind. I had to stay on the phone and at least say that.
No, it's a great... Danny, if you're still on the line, is there somebody in particular you want to sort of put that to?
I'm trying to remember the name of the people because they're very bad at names. But this is just so frustrating. I cannot believe that we don't even discuss one man, one vote, or one person, one vote in this country anymore. How is anyone going to want to vote? Me, I voted in every single election all my life. I'm 57 years old. And yet I'm finding myself really wanting to disconnect the more the system gets under money. And it's just killing me.
Professor, do you want to comment on that?
Well, I certainly appreciate Danny's frustration, but I think there's a lot of reasons why people don't vote and why the turnout level is so low. And what the academic studies have showed is some of it might be turned off by the money, but the vast majority of it is because people are happy with the system. That in their opinion, whoever gets elected, whether they'll all be the same, just as bad, or they'll all be okay, but that the academics will say that a low turnout really is an expression of a satisfied electorate.
It's an academic argument, and yet you could also say it's an expression of a group of people that is resigned. It figures neither side will do anything to make for a better government, regardless of political party.
And I will always say, in a democracy, we have the right to vote, but we also have the right not to vote.
A last word, perhaps? We've just got a couple minutes now from Peter Schweitzer.
No, I would agree with that. I don't think you can necessarily say it's money in politics that has led to lower voting. I would also say, too, that when people use the term public financing of elections, what does that actually mean? It's a great phrase, but any system you are going to set up is going to favor somebody in some way. And if you have a system of public finance where the incumbent and the challenger both get, say, the set amount of taxpayer money, it's going to favor the incumbent because they're going to have other inherent advantages. So this notion that you can set up this magical system of public financing is really just a myth.
Well, we just heard now, and I want to thank Peter Schweitzer, a conservative commentator and author of Extortion, How Politicians Extract Your Money, Buy Votes, and Line Their Own Pockets. We've also been talking to Professor Jim Sutton of Hastings College of Law, who specializes in political and election law and litigation, as well as Sheila Krumholtz, executive director for the Center for Responsive Politics and OpenSecrets.org. This is Forum on KQ Radio. I'm Rachel Miro.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.